Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you were sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
It's time to go one-on-one with DP. Coming at you live from the heart of Lincoln, America, on 93.7 The Ticket and theticketfm.com. Here is your host, Derek Pearson, brought to you by Canopy Street Market.
I lead with the boom in your face Thursday. A couple of things to talk about in this hour of one-on-one. NIL Go is going to be a thing, and in a big way. And I want to talk about it and break it down a little bit on what NIL Go is and how it may or may not affect college athletics. Lots to talk about. Yeah, let's go. We'll go into some depth with that. You can be a part of what we're doing. 402-464-5685. That is the Starter Hammer text line. If you want to reach out, please do. Hit me with a what's up. If you want to follow on the video streams, as you should, Facebook, YouTube X, LO Channel 961. Of course, download the Ticket app so that we can be where you are and go where you're going. I will get to the NIL Go and the Husker talk, but I need to ask you all a question. Do you know, or did you know, Frank Layton? Frank Layton, Francis, as he would, his wife would whisper. Frank Layton gave me my first Utah Jazz jersey ever, year 2002. After three meetings, I had moved to Salt Lake City. I was going to work with Nebraska-connected Ron Boone, of course, the father of Husker great Jerron Boone. Ron Boone had been a part of the Jazz organization through the Utah Stars days of the ABA, had been to L.A., came back to do broadcasting. Along the way, he introduced me. This gentleman introduced himself. Frank Layton slapped his bear-sized paw into the middle of my back and asked me to get up and show me who I was. 2002. Frank Layton was the former head coach of the Utah Jazz. It's part of the move from New Orleans. From them being the New Orleans Jazz to the Utah Jazz. But the story goes deeper than that, and it is way more profound than that. Folks know that I'm about mentoring and mentorship. And in full, I've said this before, and I said it when I was in Salt Lake City quite a bit. I may not have said it as much here in Nebraska, but I'll say this, and it may surprise some folks, that my favorite NBA basketball coach is not Jerry Sloan. It's not Wes Unseld. It's not Gene Shue. It is, in fact, Frank Layton. And there's several reasons why, because he instilled and installed in me some depth in coaching, paramount, in twofold. That he coached from the belief that he needed players to do two things: show up on time and play hard. And he kept it that simple. But his life philosophy was make sure that coaching is fun. Make sure you enjoy it. And for a bit, he was the comic relief of the NBA. He and Marv Alberts did those NBA highlight blooper reels, and Frank Layton was always the voice and the comic relief. He once showed up to a game in Denver wearing a Groucho Marx mask and nose.
Yeah, one of them, just quickly reading, obviously I don't have the personal connection, I don't want to say he took himself seriously, but he would make jokes about himself in a condescending way just to lighten the room. I'm reading a lot about talking about his weight, even after he dropped 85 pounds over a summer, and he's still
just funny.
Yeah.
Smart, brilliant even, but funny. Funny, the kind of funny that you know, bordering on cornball funny, but it was so authentic with him. There's the story of him in Denver. And the Jazz were bad. The early Jazz from New Orleans to Utah were bad. And he said a million times he didn't think it would work. He didn't think the move to he didn't think Salt Lake City was a big enough town to have an NBA team. He just thought, well, these folks are about family. They're not about, you know.
Fair enough. At that time, I would have been in the same boat, probably.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, they played in the Salt Palace, which was basically a convention center. Yeah. They played in a convention center. Of course, downtown Salt Lake, just a walkable distance from the Mormon temple. So the fact that it worked, you needed somebody. He said they weren't good, so he had to be funny. He couldn't sell them, so he had to sell himself, and he had to be funny. There was a trip to Denver where they were getting beat pretty bad. He tells the story that he was so upset with his team that he left the locker room and went to the tunnel, and during halftime, they're having a shooting contest. And there's a guy that, you know, hits a half-court jumper, hits a couple of threes, and hits the half-court jumper. And Frank Layden literally stalks the guy and says, hey, any chance you want to play for us? Right? And then took it a step further. And this was the brilliance of Frank Layden, was that he then actually had the guy, like, he checked in off a timeout. He put four Jazz in plus the guy who – from Denver, who won the shooting contest before the officials were like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing?
Selling the business is what I'm doing.
Right. Like, he was just, he just was good people. And the story of them being in Los Angeles and they're just getting pummeled. And he handed the keys to Jerry Sloan as the assistant coach. And when he walked across the street to the team hotel and ordered, they found him. He had ordered a sandwich and some chili and was eating during the game. Like you just said, he was just, you know, and here's the thing. When I got to Utah, it was kind of the same thing that it was here, that they didn't know me. Like Utah didn't know me. Salt Lake didn't know me. There were people who were familiar with me, but en masse, they didn't know me, and I'm certainly not the prototype for Utah Jazz basketball fans or Utah Utes or BYU. Mm-hmm. So in case you haven't figured it out, I acclimate myself pretty well to those environments, and I did. But there are two people that I owe so much to in Utah, and Ron Boone is one of them. I could probably say three. There's a gentleman, a DJ, sports talk. He was my radio buddy for a decade. Name's Alan Handy. Folks here wouldn't know him, but he was maybe one of the great comedy geniuses that I've ever been around. And Frank Layden, because Frank Layden would whisper to me, and Frank Layden, you know, he just listened. He goes, you know what? You love this basketball thing the right way. And he said it on air so that the locals who were a little bit anxious about the new guy. But here's Frank Layden saying, no, you guys need to listen to this guy. This guy's smart. This guy gets it. You know, and he goes, he's funny. He's not Frank Layden funny, but he's funny. And this is coming from Frank Layden. Mm-hmm. So, you know, okay. The great cosign is required, unfortunately, but it is. And when I got into the management side, the coaching and the management side, so the new American Basketball Association and the old Continental Basketball Association, their versions in Salt Lake City, I was a part of both of those. And he would show up at these meaningless minor league games, and he would be the loudest fan. He would sit in the front row. He would cheer on the players. He would heckle the coaches. He would heckle the officials. You know, and I mean, no holes barred. Like, you're never going to get out of this league playing like that. Like, but he meant it authentically, but it just was funny because he loved it enough to care. The history behind him, and he was a historian. So to tell you that this guy, he played at Niagara University. So Niagara University is famous for several things. Among them, this team that Frank Layden played on, and his point guard on that team was Hubie Brown. And then he came back, and his first head coaching job as a pro, college pro, was at his alma mater, Niagara, where he coached Calvin Murphy, the great Calvin Murphy, right? And you think about how crazy that is, that the connection with he and Hubie, because he and Hubie would go through Atlanta, they would go through in the process. And it was not, I can tell you, he was trying to get on the business side because he didn't think he looked the part of an NBA coach. So he was the general manager first and then became the head coach out of necessity. I mean, he spent time in Atlanta. And then so my morning show was with Ron Boone. That lasted a year. And then I went to the afternoons with another former Utah coach in Tom Nosalke. And so my afternoon, so I'm bouncing from Ron Boone to Tom Nosalke, and then eventually Hot Rod Hundley, who's maybe one of the five, like a Mount Rushmore basketball announcers in this country. Hot Rod Hundley's on that list. But Frank Layden would just, we had an old-fashioned chalkboard, and he would, every day was a master's class in basketball. He would just sit there, and then he invited me to watch the Utah Jazz with he and Tom Nosalke. Now, I would have told you I thought I was pretty knowledgeable about the X's and O's of basketball, but they were talking a different language watching this game. Like, they were speaking Greek, and I'm just trying to hold on. And you learn, oh my goodness, there's a 10th level to the 10th level in basketball at that level in the NBA and college basketball. He would sit next to, like, he would drag me to sit next to him during Utah Ute basketball games. And I wish I had, I should have just hit record on my phone and recorded the 2.5 hours of Frank Layden, the pure comedy show, and then the basketball master's class. And then the human element where he might have been the best human to coach at a major sport in this country. His wife was amazing, kind, generous. I mean, Scott Layden became a coach and executive, but they would invite you to the house. And again, it's a strange thing, the dinner table at the Layden house, right? Because the basketball talk's different and the life talk is different. When he stepped down from the Jazz and Jerry Sloan took over, and he literally handed over everything and everybody to Jerry Sloan. And when Sloan was my first day there, Frank Layden and Jerry Sloan, Frank Layden is introducing Jerry Sloan to the new guy. And then straight to the classroom. Well, let's see what you know. Draw this up. Give me UCLA. Draw it up. Right? And you, huh? Right? What are we doing? Mm-hmm. What are we doing? Okay, draw up the mind control. Draw it up. Tell me. And it was so affectionate and so good. And he literally had no reason to invest in me. He didn't know me from Adam. He had listened to me 3 days on the radio and made his way to the station to be a part of it. And throughout the course of my days in the minor leagues, he was a constant source of information, data, respect. Iconic love, like just high level. And he would always ask, are you having fun? And I would have, there's a stretch where I was the voice of the ABA and I would call the Utah ABA games. And without a fail, he would just come. There was always a seat next to me because I was the official voice. And Frank Layden would just walk up and sit down and listen. And if you want pressure, try to call a basketball game with an NBA coach of the year sitting next to you?
Would he let you know live in real time too?
You said something. Oh, like get it right. Hey, good call. Like good get. Like he would tell me. He would tell me to anticipate, but don't guess. Right? He goes, watch it. And then he would say, pacing, pacing. You're the point guard. Point. Like he would say that to you as you're calling it. And he was, you're the point guard. Set them up. What are they running? And he would just whisper the stuff. And it became a part of how I called games. And it was spectacular. But the pressure of an NBA coach of the year sitting next to you, as you call basketball.
He's acting, in a great way. I like the owner. He cares about every aspect of that team.
He cared. When I got into the executive side of the management side, he would tell me, hey, don't get too many of this kind of player. He would break down and he goes, don't get the 12 best players. Get the 12 guys who can do the things that your coach needs. And our coach was the NBA Sixth Man of the Year, Ike Austin. Ike Austin, 7 foot, behemoth of man, one NBA player, the Sixth Man of the Year, was in the top three, for 4 years. Also, a Pat Riley and Frank Layden disciple. So we would go through it, and he would say, what does Ike need? What does Ike need? And then he would ask me, what does the fan need to hear? Like, tell them what they can't see. Like, wait a minute, top of your head popped off. And to have somebody that great and that good pour into you, I try to show some of that to Nick, and allow him to find his way before I stir the pot, right? But Nick has Jay Foreman to sit next to, Eric Strickland. He has some people around him that can feed him the compliments of the game. But what I learned more from Frank Layden than anything, and I knew this was going to hit me hard. I got the phone call from a dear, as a matter of fact, he was the head coach of the CBA franchise in Utah, Scott Fields. And he was the one that gave me the news that Frank had passed away yesterday. And it just, I literally walked outside and I just sat on the bench and sat with the birds. And I just had to feel. Because he was so good for basketball and so good for sports and so good for coaching. And he would have been the same guy had he been the guy who made pizza down the street. He treated athletes the same way he treated every single fan that walked into the Delta Center in Salt Lake City. And no matter, he would go through. If you were in line at the concession stand and Frank Layden saw you, the meal was on him. And for everybody in line. Hot dogs for everybody. Like he would say, I'm not going to be the only fat one here. You guys are going to. But he.
That is such a rare human being.
He was so good. He was so good.
Well, especially when you get to that point to where you are that guy. And you refuse to act in that way that says you're better than others.
He was the NBA Executive of the Year in 1984, turning that Jazz debacle into the Stockton and Malone Utah Jazz. Coach of the Year in 1984, the NBA All-Star Game head coach, coached the West, coached the Magic, Kareem. And he talked about that being one of the great moments in his life. In true Frank Layden fashion in the postgame, the Brent Musburger asked him, is this like the greatest moment of your life, like coaching this all-star team? Mm-hmm. And he goes, this is pretty good. He goes, my honeymoon was pretty good too, though. He goes, that was fun. And I'm gonna go to Salt Lake City tomorrow morning. And I know where I'm going. And I know why I'm going. I'm not here without Frank Layden. I'm not here doing sports in Lincoln, Nebraska. The ticket doesn't exist as it currently does without Frank Layton, because the work that look and Harrison, you will vouch for this, so listeners will understand. I have three rules here: be on time, work hard, and have fun. And that man gave me that. And he had no reason to. So all the things that we do should be in that spirit. Coach, make sure that coaching is fun. Make sure that your players are enjoying themselves. Yes, they're going to work hard, but have them respected. Let the fans know that when they show up, they're going to get a team. We may not be the fastest team, the tallest team, the most athletic team, but doggone it, we're going to show up and we're going to play hard. And if we do it right, it'll be fun. And he turned the New Orleans Jazz into the Utah Jazz that were a Michael Jordan away from a dynasty in the NBA. He was just that good. When they got a WNBA team in 98, the Utah Stars, they refused to name anybody else as head coach. And so Frank Layton took the reins for 2 years and led the Natalie Williams led Utah Stars. And Tammy Reese was there. And to tell you that starting five that he had for the Utah Stars are all college coaches. All those women are now college coaches and executives.
How big was that for him to hop on the WNBA like that in a time where people just weren't? People were, and some people were even mocking it.
That, listen, you know, and it was tough for him. Like, it was tough. But he wanted to give it credibility, like, let them use his name. He would be the clown prince. I think he coached 20 games, maybe five preseason and 15, 16, 17.
But he could have coached zero.
He could have coached zero. And he said, I'm going to do this one to help them pack the place, because Frank Layton, and they had players. I mean, Tammy Reese was on that Virginia. She was Don Staley's backcourt mate at Virginia on that team. And now she's the head coach. She's the head coach. I want to say Hofstra or somewhere, but she's got a program. Natalie Williams is, as a matter of fact, she's the executive. She's the president of the volleyball team in Vegas. The ones that played against the Supernovas. Natalie Williams, that's Frank Layton's captain.
His WNBA tree is crazy just for those couple of years.
I mean, just again, everything good. There are some trees that grow great fruit. My God, Frank Layton. It's, you know, I'm this is when I know I'm getting old, because I'm losing heroes. But it also makes me stop and say thank you. So if you listen to this station, you listen to me anytime at all, you know why I say three things a lot. I need to say them the most every day. The three things I say the most, I say them on purpose. Well, this is appropriate. I say thank you, I love you, and well done. Well, Frank Layton, coach, doggone it. Thank you, I love you, well done, well done.
You're listening to One-on-One with DP, sponsored by Mary Ellen's Food for the Soul on 93.7 The Ticket and theticketfm.com.
Welcome back, One-on-One. Thank you for allowing me to babble. But Frank was worthy. Thomas and Lincoln, thank you, kind sir. He says, I would love to hear you call a Nebraska game. It was always interesting because my speaking rhythm.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And my inflection is different than a lot of folks that are traditional play-by-play guys. I also was mentored, again, I mentioned Hot Rod Hundley. He was the first who would do the NBA simulcast. So he called both TV and radio at the same time. So his call was mutual in that it would land somewhere between the traditional TV call and identifying those things that you cannot see in radio. Right.
That's a challenge, especially being the first one to do it. That's
well, and when I was in the minors, and I mean I was the voice of CBA, so I literally called their entire championship tournament.
Like
right. It's a thing. Like when Nick calls the state tournament, it's a, like I understand it, and that's why I get out of the way of it because I've been that guy and I know how to get through. But I don't want to step on toes, and I don't want him to be a mini-me. I want him to be Nick Saner because I had execs who allowed me to be me and how I called the game. There was a bit of coach in me in identifying that thing, right? That as I told you during the break, that Frank Layden would describe the game, and I had to ask him if he was a magician. Like, are you a can you see the future? And he says, well, here's the thing. You can anticipate because there are rules to the game. And if the players execute the way it's coached, it's going to have the result that I'm expecting. It's only when the player decides to do something outside of what's been coached, or as he would say, or Michael Jordan, where you're going to see them do a thing that's never been done. Julius Irving, he would often talk about the Julius Irving versus Lakers under the basket and then trying to define how Julius Irving can make the worst basketball play going baseline against two all-NBA defenders and somehow got to the other side of the glass with a one-handed palm, dipsy-do, got it to the offside of the glass, spin it down, and it goes.
Iconic. And people today don't want to give him a side tangent, but that drives me. People don't give Batman the credit he deserves.
But being able to call that is the responsibility. Directional, I need to paint the picture for the person who's calling the game. And I love the way Pavelka calls. I love the, I said when I first, people ask, are you here for the Nebraska jobs? No, I wasn't here for any of this. here for any of this. But There aren't a lot of professional play-by-play people in the state of Nebraska. I say that openly, fully, take it whatever way you want. There aren't a lot of people who have called NFL games, NBA games, Major League Baseball games, pro volleyball games, all of them.
Yeah.
I mean, There just aren't. Now, I may not be everybody's cup of tea because my identity in this thing is to call the game and to give credit. I need to dress up what the player just did. And sometimes it would require being late to the call, right? Because I need for the play to finish. And I am a huge fan of letting the game, the sounds of the game, marinate.
Yep. Then nothing will drive you nuts more when the announcer misses that moment. Especially times when it's really necessary just to hear the game and the crowd itself for 2 seconds.
I dance with the PA announcer and the crowd. It is my dance. And I have to learn what the PA announcer's rhythm and what he says so that I can add something else to what comes out of the big speakers, right? He's going to give you Basket by Karl Malone. And it's my job to then color because I know that the listener just heard that. And it's, okay, it's 27 for Malone on 13 of 22 shooting. It's a 1-point game with 6:42 left. And then let it pause, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're not doing that. You're doing that as the crowd. That as the crowd elevates on the play by Malone, let the crowd announce. Because that's what it's for. You're the listener. You feel that. Mm-hmm. You hear it and you feel it. So to do that dance, not everybody wants to do that. They will talk over it. And that's fine. Everybody has their own way. Here's my thing. I walk as a professional play-by-play person and therefore respect all play-by-play professionals. I'm never going to criticize or critique a play-by-play professional. It's too hard. It's a unique club to be in. It is definitely a hard grind. It is a beast.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I run the board plenty enough for Nick Saner when right. he's going state basketball and no breaks, new roster, new sheets, know the numbers, know the names, know how to pronounce all the last names. And by the way, you're going to be here all day with new faces and names.
It's a lot. I've told a story that, especially in pockets of the country, because there's different cultural things happening and different sports. Different sports is a Latin America factor that in the minor leagues, you have to learn how to cope with and deal with. Calling games in Utah, I had the Polynesian name issue dance that you had to go through. And ultimately, so imagine having to throw yourself 60 minutes before a game, throwing yourself into the middle of the Polynesian community and asking them to correctly tell me how to pronounce the Polynesian name, the phonetics of it and the dance of it. And then when it's, you know, when it happens and this running back's going to carry the ball 30 times, well, you better get it right. And they take pride in it. So as they're listening and they're at the game, but they're listening to you because they're not normally getting this sort of amplification and you better get it right. Right. For the high school kid, for the high school family, mom and dad, grandma and grandma who are listening either on the internet or on the radio, this is their chance to hear their grandson or granddaughter. So get it right. Like love it the way the people playing it love it and play the game with them, right? Some people are reporters, and they simply go through, and it is checks and balances, box. There's no emotional tie to it. The dance to it and the anticipation, corner three, left side, let it linger. Let it hang.
And if you're, right? You know,
and the crowd's,
like Green, you go bang, and then you like breathe.
But here's the thing. The crowd's going to tell you, too.
Yeah.
Crowd's going to tell you, too, right? It's the same time. I don't have to be first. I have to be right. And a part of my issue with some students who are being not taught this stuff is that unless you've done it in full at the highest level, you can't teach the next big name how to be authentically them when you haven't been authentically you. It's really difficult. And so, but when it's done right, and again, I love Pavelka. Like oh my God, you know, Greg Sharp owned it. Like he owned it. And so you pay respects and you know, you go through. And I wish every single play-by-play voice every glory. My goodness. I'm rooting for you because I know I have like I'm that way with, you know, people say that I'm a little too nice with coaches sometimes. Because I know how difficult it is that you can do everything right as a coach and have things go left. Like you can do everything right and it go left. As an announcer, you can prepare. And then in a moment, you know, the star quarterback who you've done 45 minutes of research and preparation for gets hurt in the second series. And now you've got a backup that you don't know tendency. You may know something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's different. It's much. Here's the thing that they don't tell you as well. It's harder for Nick Saner to call a high school game in Lincoln, Nebraska than it would be for him to call an NBA game in the NBA because he's got more help. He's got more information. He's got more resource. He's got more. You got people, interns who will do the work. You got spotters who will call it for you, and it's in your head. You don't know what's being said to you. You've got up-to-date, up-to-the-minute stats now. Like, again, 20 years, 30 years ago, I didn't have the internet to pull. Like, I didn't have a data system that would give me up-to-date stats. I had to keep them by hand. That's why you'll see old-time, old-school announcers. They've got their one of my favorite guys, Bob Carpenter, who's with the Nats. He posts his scorebook after every game. He posts his handwritten with all of his notes, key stats. If you ever want to just smile, you don't even have to be a Nats fan. But find Bob Carpenter from the Nats. He will post his postgame. Like, immediately postgame. You know, it's a win. Seven hits, four runs. But he shows all of his stats, notes, on base. Like, every little detail, direction, how hard a ball was hit, what pitch did he hit. It's easier at that level. But you can tell that he was a minor league. He was a high school announcer. He was a college announcer. He was a minor league announcer because he's been doing this thing by hand forever. If I were to call a Nebraska game now, I would have to break several decades of habit of writing this stuff down. They'd be handing me the paper. Like, they'd be
saying, did, like, you have like a buddy next to you that would, you know, keep track of that for you?
So I
you
never could call? Did. So okay. The beauty of what, okay. So I don't know if I've ever told you this. So go back to 2002 and the old ABA team. And my thing was that if you were going to call games on the road, there had to be a team.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the people back at the studio. You had to have the box. You had, you know, vector systems, old systems that you know, dial in, phone lines that you had to dial into, which was also its own pain in the butt. But I went to a development guy. I went to a data company and I asked, shout out to Jared Bronson in Salt Lake City. He was like a geek back in 2000, right?
Oh, so he's ahead of the curve.
Right. Ahead of the curve. And I said, here's what I want, because most teams didn't want to pay the numbers that it would take to broadcast every game in the minor leagues. They don't want to pay that money. I said, there's got to be a way for me to take this broadcast system with me and just plug in to a phone line and headset and call the game. And I don't need a play-by-play guy, but it was me and my producer. Like, he was the data guy. He would sit there. We would download all the commercials. Like, this is why this is stuff that when I see it now, I'm ahead of it, because back in 2002, my broadcast system was a laptop. And he had downloaded this incredible console onto the laptop. And nobody else in the league was doing it.
As a matter of fact, we do that today here at the Ticket DP. That guy's crazy ahead of his time.
Bro, this is why I was the voice of the league, because nobody else had this laptop. And nobody else had this producer who could do it. And so then they get the commissioner of the league asked me to do a weekly show. That we would stream out and broadcast back in 2004. This week in the ABA Live.
What was the producer's name again?
Jared Bronson.
Shout out Jared
Bronson. Former Navy SEAL dude.
Man. Oh, there you go.
But he was my road dog. So for the 5 years that I was the voice of minor league sports, because other teams start finding out how to do this.
Yeah.
And this is how the Clippers found me, because the summer league for the ABA was in Los Angeles, and they were scouting players, and they would come in, and the Sterling family was like, well, wait a minute, how are they doing that? Like, that's the broadcast team? Like, normally,
just two guys and a laptop. Like,
it's two guys and a laptop and headphones, and we would put all the commercials in, and of course, I would live read commercials all the time, yeah. And it was a beautiful thing, but it just wasn't being done, and it's evolved into that, but back 2004, 2005, Jared Bronson, ABA Live. The ABA had it, and then the CBA did the same thing. And then when the D League started, they brought us in because they wanted us. They wanted a laptop for every D League team back before it was the G League.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my issue was we were running things at an NBA level. And I went on this tirade that if you're going to run minor league sports, you need to run it like a pro franchise. And the best thing that would happen for minor league basketball is for the NBA to take it over and run it the way the NBA would run it. And the D League happened. I was part with Brandon Anderson in Utah. that was amazing. And then the D League involved merged in and became the G League that it is now.
Yeah, I did not hear that story. That, I can imagine how that would kind of break the media landscape for a little bit. And that's why I had to ask about your producer's name again, because, yeah, you're putting all that money, you're getting all these massive crews together, all that equipment, and then you're just seeing two dudes with one laptop
you will
and
see,
a headset.
I'll show you a picture of us. As a matter of fact, the Rocky Mountain Review, the NBA Summer League, back then, we were the first ones to use the laptop to broadcast.
Were you aware of like how big it was at the moment?
No, I was. It was totally badass because the NBA hired me and Jared to go out and announce the NBA Summer League. We did every NBA Summer League game for 3 years. Back then, the Summer League was in Long Beach, California, at the Pyramid, the old Long Beach State deal. As a matter of fact, that's where I met Rock Lloyd, Ramon Lloyd. Right.
Where does Boone come into all this? Because it was that
your first he was on the ABA team in Utah.
Okay, that's the connection. Okay.
Jerron Boone, Tony Farmer, uh-huh. When we were on the road for the Utah Snow Bears, ABA, Tony Farmer was my roommate. And the other roommate that I had on the road was Alex Austin, father of Baylor 7-footer Isaiah Austin.
Okay.
Bro, it is like when I tell you that the world, it's just. But
everyone ended up in that place at the right time.
Well, it's a core of how things work. And when I try to explain to people that there are very few things in sports that I haven't seen, because I've seen a version of it, and then the evolved version of it, and then the developed version of it, and then the current version of it, and then that helps me see the next version of it. And that's what happens. That's what happens. And speaking of, we'll talk about the next version. NIL Go, the next version. We'll talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to One-on-One with DP, brought to you by Canopy Street Market on 93.7 The Ticket and theticketfm.com.
Oh, Mike, thank you, kind sir. Kind words on the text line. Appreciate it. Cubsker, always good. Always good to have you hang out. But, yeah, that internet, first minor leagues that were putting the games on the internet direct to their website for traffic and money, to consume and keep all of the revenue, which was crazy. And it cut the cost because it was only a 2-man crew rather than the 9 or 10 that the NBA teams were using.
Yeah. And you showed me the break just for proof. Like I saw them. It's literally,
yeah.
I'd be so upset if I was like a big time station, like ESPN, seeing it and then just seeing how are these guys being the first ones to get it on the internet with just a laptop, headset, and two dudes.
And they picked it up, and then we learned how to share the feed with the radio stations. So we would broadcast from the internet. We'd travel the country, and then we would send it back to our station in Utah and or, you know, to whatever other city that we were playing in. So it was
groundbreaking. We're doing that again. I have to keep saying we're doing that in 2025. That was 21 years ago.
Bruh, it is. Every now and then, sometimes I forget how crazy stuff has been. I want to read this so you understand this craziness that is. NIL Go. It is actually a thing.
Yeah, I had to put out a memorandum today.
Yep, memorandum that the NCAA issued two separate documents addressing the impact of the House settlement and otherwise. But NIL Go will be the clearinghouse for agreements, NIL agreements, between collectives, athletes, and universities. Mm-hmm. And it is setting for the standard for any deal above $600. Any deal above $600.
Now, that's pretty much, I mean, you're talking football players. I shouldn't say it. Just puts just about everybody on the table there for $600. That's not the massive amount.
Right. That's an appearance. That's shoot it. Like, it's the whole thing. And the rules of engagement is, it says, according to the mayors, to efficiently clear legitimate third-party NIL deals with a total value of $600 or more, reflect the true market dynamics for NIL deals without arbitrary value regulations, and support enforcement schools and student athletes following the approval of the House settlement. Part of the deal, the process, schools will initially determine the association of payers, i.e. whether they are associated entities or individuals to the university, to determine where the fair market value assessment is required. In doing so, schools will use several criteria, such as whether the entity slash individual exists primarily to support the athletics program, provides exclusive NIL opportunities for the school, or contributes more than $50,000 over a lifetime and employs or owns certain roles tied to the school or associated entities. Part two, valid business purpose verification. Next, schools will determine whether payer's intent is to use the student's NIL to legitimately advance business objectives. On the payer level, the school will verify the payer's identity and intent. And on the deal level, the school will review the details of the NIL deal and any supporting documents for purpose of flagging any issues. Third, range of compensation analysis. Finally, the clearinghouse will use a 12-point analysis to assess whether the compensation aligns with similarly situated individuals and comparable NIL deals. This range of compensation analysis will apply solely to third-party NIL deals with associated entities, collectives, or individuals using historical deal data involving both college and professional athletes as benchmarks and excluding roster value and recruiting incentives. Deloitte will assess factors such as athletic performance, social media presence, local and institutional market size, which means you can't just pay somebody and bury them, right? They actually have to be somebody of note, with name and brand influence to determine the fair market value of each individual student athlete's deal. Upon completion of the process, the clearinghouse will communicate the status of each individual deal as either cleared in review, information needed, or denied. If a student athlete's deal falls into either of the latter two categories, either i.e. not cleared, the student athlete has four options. They may renegotiate and resubmit the items to the deal, proceed at risk of eligibility consequences. Student athlete's deal instead allowing the student athlete to make his or her own decision to accept the deal with the understanding that they risk eligibility. And when I tell you out loud, for the collectives that are in play, this is a gut punch. This is.
Well, I think they say in there at some point too, like they're trying to get some more information from these schools and they're just not hearing back from them. So it kind of tells you exactly what you're saying. They're in a tight spot right now because they don't even want to talk back, knowing that they know they got a problem on their hand.
Because deals have been done.
Exactly.
And these collectives, the power swing is happening. It's happening.
They stated it in the House settlement, though. That's why I'm a little bit, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but in the House settlement, they said what the College Sports Commission was going to do, an NIL go, and how this is just going to be enforced more.
They didn't believe you. They didn't believe you.
Power. Insanity to not take that seriously. Well,
all I'm saying is, imagine being an unattached entity who could provide legitimate, fair value business deals, not just for the sake of donation, but to actually teach them a business trade that has market value, literally trackable.
Merit to
compliant,
it.
Compliant, trackable business deals. Do we know anybody? Do we know anybody who could set up student athletes in a valid, compliant business situation outside of collective and university? If you know of anybody, hit your boy up. Let me know. Y'all be good. Ticket weeknights. Coming up, Harrison and the gang will take you through. Y'all be good. Please.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.